Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Dearborn, Michigan, and earned an LLB from Wayne State University Law School. He served as Oakland County's prosecuting attorney from 1989 to 1996 and gained national prominence for prosecuting Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Since 1998, he's been the president and chief counsel for the Thomas More Law Center, which is dedicated to the defense and promotion of America's Judeo-Christian heritage and moral values. His name, Richard Thompson. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to the president and chief counsel of the Thomas More Law Center, Richard Thompson. Dick, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you very much, Jack. Nice being with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I was born in Dearborn, Michigan, as you indicated. My parents were immigrants to this country. My dad worked most of his life at the Ford Motor Company on the assembly line. When I was 14 years old, I decided that I wanted to go to a military school. So my dad saved the money, and I went to the Stanton Military Academy in Stanton, Virginia, where I spent 4 years, graduated there, and then went to University of Michigan for an undergraduate degree. While at the University of Michigan, I was involved with ROTC, got a commission as a second lieutenant, went into the military, spent time at Fort Benning, Georgia in the basic officer infantry course, and then from there went to Army Intelligence School, and from there was assigned to the Army Intelligence Center at Fort Holabird, Maryland, which I understand is no longer there. And then when I got back, I went to Wayne State University Law School, got out, practiced private, was in private practice for a while at the Detroit law firm, went out on my own, then ultimately went to the prosecutor's office as a Brooks Patterson's chief assistant prosecutor for 16 years, and then from then became the elected prosecutor for 8.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
My mother was a very sweet individual, and her whole persona was being nice to everybody. My dad, on the other hand, was a tough guy, but he also was very religious, very read the Bible every day, and also he believed in doing what was right regardless of the consequences. So I think I took, you know, most of my character building from my parents.
With all of the military exposure, Dick Thompson, how was it you chose a career in law?
Well, law is, when I was thinking about law, I was thinking about trial practice, and it was combat in a different arena in the courts. And, you know, in those days, you know, I looked at being a lawyer as defending the downtrodden, defending the innocent from the power of the government. And so I started out being a litigator. Ultimately, I found out the law practice wasn't that dramatic in the cases that I was handling. I was working for a firm that handled insurance defense work. Then I decided I wanted to do something more meaningful. And when Brooks offered me the job as his chief assistant, second in command, I took that and enjoyed that very much.
Dick, what makes a great lawyer?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure I can answer it fully, but I would say someone who is, first of all, intelligent, who's devoted to his profession, someone who has high ideals. We have a canons of professional ethics, someone that will do that, someone who has to be devoted to the cause of his client, his or her client. If you're going to be a litigation lawyer, you have to be able to think on your feet, make good arguments to the jury. If you're going to be an appellate lawyer, then you have to have great writing skills, ability to argue your case before a panel of judges. You know who makes a good lawyer? Salespeople make good lawyers. when they have to persuade a jury or when they have to persuade a judge as to the righteousness of their cause. So I think it takes a lot of commitment to go through 3 years of law school, and then that desire to seek justice on behalf of your client, whomever that client is.
If there's a young person who's considering a career or a vocation in law today, what would you say to that person?
Go someplace else. law, it depends on what kind of law you practice. There are certain kinds of law that I think would be very boring. I wouldn't want to be a real estate lawyer. I wouldn't want to be a corporate lawyer, although they are, you know, they're necessary and they're important. I like litigation. I like the activity in the courtroom. I like the challenge in the courtroom. But seriously speaking, if you want to be a lawyer, and a lot of people who start out in law start out because they want to benefit society, and that's a good mission to have. And if you're going to do that, I think, starting out in law school, getting internships with actual law firms, because law schools don't teach you how to be a lawyer. They teach you how to think like a lawyer. You have to really be in a law firm so you start getting the idea of what a lawyer is all about.
In 1989, you run to become Oakland County's prosecuting attorney. You win. Why did you run for that position?
I love being a prosecutor. I was, as I said, 16 years as Brooks Patterson's chief assistant, and he was a wonderful person to work for. And then Brooks decided he was going to go out into private practice. He had 16 years, and he was going to do something else. Now, if I wanted to keep my job, I knew that I'd have to run for prosecutor, because the next prosecutor that came in would not, you know, keep me on board. He'd pick someone that he had implicit trust in. And so the prosecutor normally picks someone who is going to get along with him and who's going to do what he wants, and they'll bring their own person aboard. So I realized that if I wanted to stay in a prosecutor's office, if I wanted to continue the tough, no plea bargaining policies that Brooks initiated when he became prosecutor, then I had to run. And it was something that I had to break open that envelope. I was not a politician. I was more of a person that, you know, looked at the internal workings of the office, make sure the office was running right, like a chief executive officer rather than the person who's chairman of the board.
We're talking to Dick Thompson, who prosecuted a certain person that changed his life and changed that person's life too, and many others. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Prasula, and we're with Dick Thompson, who from 89 to 96 was Oakland County's prosecuting attorney. And you prosecuted a certain person and gained national prominence. Talk about that.
I think you're referring to Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Death. It was a case that we never prepared for. In other words, it was never an issue in the campaign. Physician-assisted suicide was not something that was discussed. And in my first year as an Oakland County prosecutor, Jack Kevorkian decided he was going to start his experiments on physician-assisted suicide. The first victim was Janet Atkins, a woman who came from Oregon, suffering from the early stages of Alzheimer's, read about Jack Kevorkian in a newspaper, and decided she wanted to take advantage of what he was offering, death. And in a they had this meeting in Madison Heights where he interviewed her. We know what was said in that interview because he videotaped the interview. 2 days later, he killed her in a rusty old Volkswagen in an Oakland County public park, and then started this whole controversy over physician-assisted suicide. Ironically, even though this was not something that was openly discussed in politics in Oakland County or statewide, it became first a state issue, a controversial state issue. Then it became a national and international issue. And the question became, does the state, does the government have a right to stop someone from killing themselves if they either have a physical illness that they don't want to deal with anymore, or they're just tired of life? Those were the kinds of issues. And of course, as a prosecutor, I did what I thought was my sworn duty, and that was enforcing the law. The state police investigated the case. We looked at the facts, and we believe that he was guilty of first-degree murder. We charged him with first-degree murder, and a firestorm of protest occurred. People thought that he was an angel of mercy. He was helping people who were suffering excruciating pain, who may be terminally ill, from leaving this life without any kind of ill effects. And that became the battle. And the next several years, that was the issue that Oakland County had to deal with.
When you started, Dick, 70% of Michigans supported his cause. And I think 85% in Oakland County supported it. What changed?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, people started to pay attention to exactly what he was doing. Although he would indicate, I'm following these strict procedures, these strict guidelines that I'm testing people to see if they are terminally ill and suffering excruciating pain, we found out that most of the people that he killed were not terminally ill. Actually, I think it was 3 out of 4 people that he killed were not terminally ill. The reason why we found out is because the medical examiner would do an autopsy. Secondly, we found through interviews that the people that he was getting involved with many times just were tired of life. Some of them had psychiatric problems. Some of them realized that their kids, the families that they would depend upon for support, no longer wanted to support them. And so Jack Kevorkian offered this easy way out. As people realized that, then they started to change. The Catholic Church became very involved in this. This became a pro-life issue. This became an issue of whether government should assist people in killing themselves. So when the Catholic Church got involved, they started to develop the moral and theological basis for opposing physician-assisted suicide. Up until that point, my job I looked at as enforcing the law, but merely saying you're enforcing the law was not adequate enough because a lot of people thought, here is Jack Kevorkian coming into court. He has the family members coming in and saying what a great job he did as a doctor, and normally prosecutors wear the white hat. They're in there, you know, prosecuting rapists, murderers, and the jury is on your side. In these cases, we found out that the jury was not on our side. They were supporting Jack Kevorkian. And many of the cases that we tried ended up in not guilty verdicts because of jury nullification. They didn't like the fact that we were enforcing this particular law. But as people became aware of it, as the church started to speak out on this issue, as they realized that a lot of people were being victimized into desiring Jack Kevorkian's brand of medicine, public opinion changed.
That case changed your life?
Yes.
Then in 1998, Tom Monahan calls you, says, come on, let's talk. I've got an idea. And I need you to turn that idea into a reality. And from that was formed the Thomas More Law Center. One, why did you accept that offer? And two, tell us about the Thomas More Law Center.
Okay. Number one, to finish the story with Jack Kevorkian, when he had all this publicity, he thought he could change the law. So he started a petition drive, putting it on the ballot, the legalization of physician-assisted suicide. That is what actually prompted the Catholic Church to get involved. But in that battle, I had already lost my job to a challenger who said that he was no longer going to enforce the law against Jack Kevorkian. But I said, well, I lost my job over this. I might as well fight against this proposal, Proposal B. And so I went out speaking at different places. One of the places I spoke to was a Catholic business organization called Legatus. And I spoke at that and talked about the issue of pro-life and physician-assisted suicide. From that point, I think Tom Monahan, registered me in his memory bank. And when he had an opportunity to decide to support a particular attorney general for the state of Michigan, he asked the Republican Party to support John Smetanka. I don't know if you remember that name, but he was a pro-life candidate. Tom Monahan, one day as I was walking down the hall, called me aside, and I remember very vividly Father Fessio, a great Jesuit priest was with him, and he said, Dick, what are you doing? I said, I'm just going to this Catholic Medical Association to give a speech. He says, why don't you come work for me? That was it. I didn't have any other position at that time. He explained it was for a pro-life candidate, so I accepted that, did the job, and then later on he said, you know, I want to change the culture. How can we change the culture? And I said, there's two things you can do. And one is to have a Catholic law school. And the second thing was to have a Catholic public or public interest law firm that would advance Christian causes. Because what I was finding out is that the major determiner of the cultural issues that was facing America was not being done by the president. The executive branch was not being done by the legislative branch. It was being controlled and determined by the judicial branch, the one branch that is not elected, that hold lifetime appointments, and they were slowly dismantling the Judeo-Christian principles upon which this country was founded. And you can go down the list, and it was the Supreme Court, you know, that decided Roe v. Wade out of thin air. Congress didn't vote on it. The president didn't vote on it. Then, starting in 1962, we had the elimination of prayers in school. We had the elimination of Bible reading in the school. In 1989, they started to destroy nativity scenes on public property because it was religious. In 1992, they started to eliminate prayers at public high school graduation, saying that's no good. They started to eliminate crosses and Ten Commandments. This was a war on Christianity that was being led by the court. The courtroom became the major battleground of the culture war, and not enough Christian lawyers were in that battleground. And so we thought that this was a place where we could make a difference. Tom Monahan agreed, and he gave us the seed money to start the Thomas More Law Center. Our mission is to promote and defend the Judeo-Christian heritage and moral values, and also at this point we are also defending a free and sovereign United States of America and supporting national defense and national security. That's our mission right now.
We're talking to Dick Thompson, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula, and we're with Dick Thompson, the president and chief counsel for the Thomas More Law Center. Dick, the HHS mandate and the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has filed 34 lawsuits against HHS. During the vice presidential debate, Vice President Joe Biden, who's a Catholic, said, you guys don't have to worry about a thing. Dick, he's a Catholic. Why is the Catholic Church so concerned about this mandate?
Well, first of all, Joe Biden was wrong. The Catholic Church and every Christian who's concerned about religious freedom should worry about this. And this is one of the things that's important to recognize. The debate on the HHS mandate is not about contraception. It's about religious freedom. Remember in 2010 when Nancy Pelosi said, but we have to vote for this bill so we can find out what it's all about. Most of our representatives voted for the bill not even having read it. Well, now we're finding out what it's all about. And what we found out is this. For the first time in the history of our country, the President of the United States has intentionally and willfully waged war against a particular religious denomination, as well as a First Amendment right to free exercise of religion and free conscience. Because what the HHS mandate says to all people of faith is this. You either have to violate your faith or violate the law. You make the choice. And what this means is, under the law, if you're an employer that has 50 or more employees, you have to support the mandates of HHS, which means that you have to pay for insurance coverage of abortifacients, sterilization, and contraception. If you don't support those that insurance coverage, you have to pay $2,000 per employee per year for your violation. Now, we're representing Legatus, which is the national organization of top CEOs and business owners. And we're also representing an individual by the name of Dan Weingartz and his company, Weingartz Supply Company. Dan Weingartz has 170 employees. His religious faith, he being a Catholic, indicates that abortion, abortifacient, sterilization, contraceptions are sin. It's been a sin for 2,000 years as far as the Catholic Church is concerned. So he's been put on the position of either violating the principles of his faith or paying about $320,000 a year for penalties because he's not going to provide this insurance. This should not be an issue that the government should be involved with. They should allow the free exercise of religion. And the history of our country indicates that conscience, the person's conscience, the free exercise of religion is the primary, the paramount right that an individual has. And so what the federal government has done is attempt to squash that particular primary right that the individual has. You know, Catholic Cardinal Francis George in 2010, looking at the landscape and looking at the history of the exercise of religion in the United States, said this in a prophetic way. Now, Cardinal George is not prone to hyperbole, but he said this: "I will die in bed, my successor will die in prison, and his successor will die a martyr in the public square." He was making a prophecy of what was going to happen. Cardinal Raymond Burke, the former cardinal of the Archdiocese of St. Louis, who is now the president or the Supreme Court of Vatican, the chief of the Supreme Court of the Vatican, he said just last year, the United States has declared war on the Catholic Church. So this is what Catholics have to face. But this is more than a Catholic issue, because our Protestant brethren are looking at what is happening to the Catholic Church, and they know that if the federal government can bring the Catholic Church to its knees, then they will be next. And so I remember this comment made by a Protestant pastor on a TV program when they were discussing the HHS mandate. He said, "We're all Catholic now, because Christians have to come together to defeat this mandate that tramples on the primary principle, the first rights that we as Americans have, and that is the right to free exercise of religion." That was a part of our Declaration of Independence. When you look at what the Declaration of Independence said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equally, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are the right to life, liberty, and property. And that's what we're discussing about. The sacred rights that we got from God are now being trampled upon by the federal government.
In the last segment, you mentioned that we're in a battle for the soul of America. And a while ago you told me, and I quote, "The war in America is really for our youth and the next generation." Please.
Well, yes. I mean, that's, I don't think they're going to change your view and my view and the view of people that have already gone through the public school system that are in middle age. But they are there. We have to be aware that there is indoctrination going on in the public schools, that there is a certain ideology, a far left ideology, that is taking place. That ideology involves homosexuality as equal to heterosexuality. That ideology involves abortion as it is proposed by Planned Parenthood. That ideology involves multiculturalism without in effect, denigrating the history of our founding. And so our public school system has become an indoctrination center. And we have to keep in mind, of course, if you're a parent and you can afford it, you can send your child to a religious school or a private school. 90% of Christian students, though, go to public school. So we have to be aware of that. So our concern is, what is happening to these young people who are being indoctrinated at this point? And if we don't stand up and speak out, if we don't stop the insidious attack that the ACLU has and Americans United for Separation of Church and State and the Foundation for Religious Freedom, they have this insidious attack that wherever they find a symbol of Christianity, they move to file a lawsuit to eradicate it from the public square. Their operating principle is out of sight, out of mind. So there is a war on Christianity that is going on. We have to be aware of it, or else we're going to lose our next generation and the generations thereafter.
Some would say, Richard Thompson, you're a maniac. You've gone overboard. You're crazy. You're a fanatic. What do you say?
There are some things you have to be zealous about. There are some things you draw a line and say, we've had enough. It's too important to let the sacrifices of our founding fathers, starting in 1775 through Valley Forge to the Korean War, Vietnam War, World War II, now the wars in the Middle East. Men and women sacrificed their lives for the principles of our Constitution. I don't think it's too much for me and others to stand in the breach here in the United States and say they sacrificed their lives for a nation based on Christian principles. And we have to do our part here in the United States. As Abraham Lincoln once said, in I think it was about in 1838, we don't have to worry about some foreign power coming across the oceans to defeat us. If we are defeated, it's going to be by our own hand. We are going to live forever or die by suicide. That was Abraham Lincoln. There is an internal threat going on in our country. And we as patriotic Christian citizens have to realize that there is this internal threat, and we have to stand in the breach and fight it, or else we are going to lose the Judeo-Christian principles upon which our founders founded this country, and our nation will ultimately disintegrate.
We're talking to Dick Thompson, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Dick Thompson, who gained national prominence for prosecuting Dr. Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Death, in the early 90s. Whereas some would say you're a maniac, others say I admire you. And some of them might say you and your team's efforts and mission is akin to going to war with a bread knife. This is a tidal wave that's going on, and we can't stop it. Why even take it on?
Well, first of all, we have the responsibility to those who came before us when they sacrificed their lives for this country, for the principles of the Declaration of Independence. I think we always have to go back to the Declaration of Independence. That's our birth certificate. Those are the foundations upon which this nation was built. Those are the foundations upon which our founding fathers basically established this country. So I think that's important. The other thing is we have to keep in mind that it doesn't matter how many people you have in the war. It matters how zealous you are on whether you are on God's side. There is the Old Testament story about Gideon and Gideon's army. When he was fighting, I forgot the name of the opponents, and they had 130,000 soldiers against Gideon's 30 or 60,000 soldiers, and God told him he had too many soldiers. And so he devised a way to reduce it down, and then he had 30,000, and then God said, that's still too many soldiers, and he reduced it down. Ultimately, he only had 300 soldiers versus 130,000 soldiers, and he won the war. And the principle there is you want to be on God's side. You don't say we want God to be on our side. We have to say we want to be on God's side. And to be on God's side, of course, takes some consideration, takes some reading of the Bible, takes some thought to say what, you know, the old saying, what would Jesus do? What would God do? Now, there's this idea of, you know, Jesus was this meek and mild person, but I don't think of him that way. I think of him as the person that turned over the tables in the temple. He said, I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Those are his words. And when he saw the money changers in the temple, of course, to maintain peace, he could have just turned around and walked away, and no one would have said anything, and there wouldn't have been any ruckus about it. But he didn't do that. He didn't stand silent in the face of unrighteousness. He spoke out. He used his, he made a whip and scourge and drove out the money changers out of the temple. So my message to Christians is that peace is not our goal. Righteousness is our goal. That's what we have to fight about. And Christians were born for combat. We have to understand that. So we have to fight for these issues because it's so important. It's so important for the future of our nation, so important for the souls of our children, grandchildren, and future generations.
We're talking to Dick Thompson. If you want to learn more, www.thomasmore.org. www.thomasmore.org. In 3 years ago, a group of Judeo-Christian leaders got together and they wrote the Manhattan Declaration. Tell us about that document.
Well, the Manhattan Declaration, as you indicated, was a document that was formulated by Christians, Catholics, Roman Catholics, Evangelical Protestants, and Orthodox ministers. And it was a bright line that they said forth, talking about the Christian position on right to life, the Christian position on religious freedom, the Christian position on, I forgot some other of the other indications. But they took a bright line and said, as Christians, we believe these things. Oh, the other one was marriage, on marriage and the family. We believe these things. Now, obviously, these individuals come from different, they're Christian, but they come from different denominations. But all the these various ideas they all agreed with, and they have set up this bright line. They've asked a lot of people that believe in the same way to also sign this petition that I guess is online someplace. It's an important document because for several reasons. Number one, it's Christians coming together in a combination that shows that they are concerned about the direction of our country. And there's another thing in that document. It talks about civil disobedience as well. I think they are beginning to see that there is a battle that's going to come on, and it's a battle going to be between people of faith and the militant atheist. And that battle is going to determine the future of our nation, whether we are going to be one nation under God or whether we're going to go the way of a lot of other empires went, starting out great and then disappearing.
One of the current cases you're litigating is the 55-foot cross in Frankenmuth that was erected in 1976 for the bicentennial. Our fathers had this separation of church and state. So the Americans United for Separation of Church and State have filed a lawsuit against the city of Frankenmuth to take that 55-foot cross down. It's on public property. Aren't they right?
First of all, our founding fathers never said separation of church and state. That phrase is never, it's not in our Constitution. It's not in our Declaration of Independence. It was found in a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to some Baptists in which he was talking about, don't worry about it, the national government is not going to establish a national religion. What our founding fathers really believed in is that we are, if we are a nation that operates under the consent of the people, then if we are going to be successful, those people have to be religious. George Washington said the foundation of our political prosperity is morality and religion. So our founding fathers never wanted to separate religion from the state. What they meant in one way was render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and unto God that which is God. But that just meant that there is a difference between the secular state and the religious state. But there should be no separation as far as the influence that the religious state, the religious aspect of that nation imposes on, or at least attempts to persuade the secular state to abide by. Most of our laws come from a religious background. And therefore, I think it's important to realize that the separation of church and state is not a part of our Constitution. What they did with the Frankenmuth Cross, I think, is celebrating the bicentennial, and that's what they were doing. They were not trying to coerce anyone to become a Christian.
You're in this battlefield every day fighting. Are you hopeful for America?
Obviously I am, or else we wouldn't be fighting. There is hope. But hope takes two, as St. Augustine said one time, hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger, because you're upset with the things the way they are. Courage, to make them the way they should be. And so we have to be angry about what's going on, but we have to have the courage to stand up and fight the good fight.
Speaking of courage, as our time winds down tonight, Dick Thompson, what advice do you give to our young listeners?
Read the Ten Commandments and follow the Ten Commandments.
That says it all. I commend you for being in that battlefield every day when the odds seem overwhelming. It doesn't take but a few great men and women to make a huge difference. Keep up the great work.
Thanks a lot, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.